Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, continuing with our conversations with remarkable minds, F. William Engdahl will talk about understanding the current coup in Turkey and the history of the CIA and the U.S. involvement with the Muslim Brotherhood and Islamic terrorism and how they've used different organizations, clearly that are terrorist organizations, to serve their regime change agenda. Who are these people? Who has that power? None of this is discussed in the mainstream media. Why? Are they unaware of it? Or are they simply realizing that they should self-censor because there'll be a consequence? We believe these are some of the most powerful forces in the world who've decided that they want to see a regime change because they have something in it for them, and then using the various governmental agencies, using the people they selected before we elected them to carry out their mandates. Now, going to Germany, we are on Skype, which is a little different technical quality, but surely will be completely understandable, is F. William Engdahl. That's E-N-G-D-A-H-L. He's a multi-award-winning geopolitical analyst, a strategic risk consultant, and an author who specializes on the rise of the U.S. as an international superpower. His writings deal with empire building through the roles of financial control of global banking, the food chain, medicine, and bioengineering and energy, and primarily oil. He holds degrees in political science from Princeton University, did graduate work in comparative economics at Stockholm University in Sweden, and he's taught at Beijing University and lectured widely throughout the world. And he has taught at economic institutions in Russia, Turkey, London, Croatia, and elsewhere. And his articles appear in Global Research, New Eastern Outlook, Asia Times, Financial Sense, RT, and others. He is also the author of an important new book, Lost Hegemon, Whom the Gods Would Destroy, which provides a history of the U.S. intelligence relationship with the origins of Islamic terrorists and jihadi organizations and movements. His website is williamengdahl.com. Nice to have you with us again.
Gary, it's very good to be with you again.
Most people are either not informed, only cursorily interested in what is happening in the Middle East, especially Turkey. We've heard a lot about Iraq and Afghanistan, less about the real reasons we went into Syria and Libya and the Sudan and Mali, and we know nothing as a general population about our relationships to the various regimes. All we know is that we've been telling the public Israel's our most important ally, and therefore we must give it at least $3 billion, more likely $5 billion in military assistance per year, because there's so many terrorists who would like to take them out. Now along comes Turkey. Turkey's a pretty good-sized country. It also has a long history. It was the Ottoman Empire, and for hundreds of years it ruled over a large segment of that area of the world, and today, it seems as though the current president, Erdogan, wants to bring back something of the Turkish Empire's Ottoman origins. And to do so, he has aligned himself with some of the ultra-conservative, fundamentalistic Islamic clerics in the area, in effect supporting one of what many would consider the more radical forms of Islam. On the other hand, historically, Turkey was a more secular society. It had some actually progressive concepts. And so why then the coup? Why a coup? Well, then you're going to take us now, take your time, through this very convoluted chess game. We don't know all the characters. All that I know from looking at all this is that none of them look good. They all look bad. But in that mix, over the weekend, President Obama made a statement, and he was unequivocal. He stated the United States and its agencies, and he had no knowledge of this coup, had no participation in it or support of it. And that's what he said in a conversation he had with him. I don't believe the President of the United States ever. I don't believe any of these agencies because they're never going to tell you the truth. If they told you the truth, you would then say, well, why were you supporting a coup? What do you mean that the CIA was involved for dozens of years? What do you mean that they had billions of dollars in Turkey, in different institutions, and they had lots of leading people in the military, educational institutions, they controlled the media? Why? Why would we be doing that? And that would open up can worms that they could not possibly, and especially Hillary Clinton at this time, could not possibly justify. So, regarding the recent military coup in Turkey, to oust its current president, Erdogan, his major opponent, Gulen, plays a prominent role. And Gulen, G-U-L-E-N, is a former close ally of the president, currently lives in exile in the United States as a CIA asset. It was recently reported by Judicial Watch that Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, had a close relationship with this man and some of his supporters. And one in particular, a man named Ozcock, served as a national advisor on one of the pro-Clinton PACs and contributed to her presidential campaign. So please take your time and explain to us this relationship between Clinton, the Obama administration, and the CIA with this Gulen's movement. And who is this man as an Islamic cleric? Who does he represent? And what kind of Islamic revolution in Turkey does he promote? The forum is yours.
Fethullah Gulen, first of all, I think properly seen is a CIA Hollywood fiction and not a real person. Yes, there is a 75-year-old man with a very grandfatherly, benign-looking white mustache and white hair and smile for the cameras. And he is in Sadlersburg, Pennsylvania, in a very elaborate walled-in mansion with a lot of bodyguards protected by the CIA. Yes, there is such a person, but that is not the creator of an empire that scans multiple countries, including charter schools, numerous charter schools, state-supported, controlled by Gulen's ideology, Islamist jihad ideology in reality, in the United States, in Germany, across Europe, and all the way through Eurasia, up into the Uyghur ethnic Turkic peoples of Xinjiang province in western China, where all the oil pipelines crisscross. So Fethullah Gulen is a project of U.S. intelligence, has been for four decades when he was picked up as a useful potential tool, as a right-wing nationalist. The Turkish right-wing in the 70s was very right-wing. I mean, the Grey Wolves give you an idea of that. The ones who took a pot shot at the Pope back then, if you remember. The Gulen movement was chosen as a useful vehicle by U.S. intelligence to capitalize on the unique geopolitical. It has nothing to do, by the way, with religion. And the sooner we get that out of our mind and realize that people have these religious beliefs, and if you manipulate those religious beliefs, you can manipulate people to think they're doing something good. But in reality, the Gulen Project has nothing to do with religion and moderation and so forth. They have the idea to use Turkey. If you look at a map of Eurasia and of Turkey in relation to Eurasia, it is what the geopolitical people would call a pivot state. You control Turkey, and through that, you can pivot in any direction, east, west, north, south. You can pivot towards Russia. You can pivot toward the Arab world. Turkey is not an Arab country. It's a Turkic country, ethnically. It's Sunni Turkic Islam, but it's Turkic. You can pivot toward Europe and so forth. So in reality, the geographical situation, the geopolitical situation of Turkey is rather unique, and this is something that the United States State Department and geopoliticians, their geographers, discovered back in the 1940s when they were mapping out the post-war U.S.-dominated world after World War II. And they decided very early on to bring Turkey into NATO against the Soviet Union in 1952 or 53. And the same year they brought Greece in, that had a little bit of friction between the two cultures because of a lot of historical reasons. But in any case, Turkey then began to become integrated, not by necessarily free will, but given no choice because of the Cold War, integrated into the networks of U.S.-dominated NATO. And there were revelations, some 15 years ago, about networks of NATO throughout Western Europe, throughout NATO countries, called Gladio, the stay-behind networks, in the event of a Soviet march to take over Europe. And those networks would do sabotage and so forth. Well, Gladio did and does exist, but these are not stay-behind networks in the event of a Soviet takeover. These are covert networks buried by the Pentagon and by U.S. intelligence in these various NATO countries, and most of all into Turkey because of its unique geographical role. So they built up this Fethullah Gulen project through the 80s into the 90s. He's a nothing. He's a non-entity. The man didn't finish the fifth grade. He's touted. He got his permanent resident papers, green card in the United States in 2007 on the intervention of three CIA agents, high-ranking CIA agents, who claimed that he had extraordinary scholarly resources to give to the world. And the State Department, ironically, back then it wasn't so corrupted as it became under Hillary, the State Department said, this man has a fifth grade education. His work is not at all scholarly. He has an extremely wide-ranging economic network, business commercial network, and they compared him, some people compared him with Opus Dei. So that begins to give a little idea we're dealing with here. And what Gulen did, or what the handlers of Gulen did, Graham E. Fuller of the CIA, now supposedly retired, but he seems very active in defending his relation with Gulen in the last few days after the coup failure. Graham E. Fuller and others in the CIA built this project after the collapse of the Soviet Union to begin infiltration of predominantly Islamic cultures of the former Soviet Union in Kazakhstan, in Kyrgyzstan, in Azerbaijan. Most of these countries are ethnically or religiously Muslim, but they were a very soft version of Muslim, non-violent, non-jihadist, and so forth. It was very private. It was more like what traditionally is called Sufi Muslim. And the Gulen networks came in well-financed, by the way, extremely well-financed. Some maintain it had to do with trafficking in heroin from Afghanistan and other places. Even the State Department alleged that this might be the case in their testimony against Gulen's green card, by the way. And Gulen's organization, SEMAT in Turkish, the organization began to build madrasas or elite schools, not just ordinary schools, but elite schools targeting the children of the leading clans or families of these Islamic former Soviet Union newly formed republics in the 1990s. And in one case, the former head of Turkish intelligence, since deceased, wrote in his memoirs that Turkish intelligence had documented one of the Gulen schools in Uzbekistan had 130 teachers, English-speaking Native American teachers, who they identified as CIA agents masquerading as teachers. So imagine in 1992, 93, you can funnel 130 CIA agents parading as English teachers into these formerly untouchable areas of the Soviet Union for military and other reasons, and wreak havoc and chaos and so forth, which is what the U.S. did. They wanted to make such a chaos and destruction of the former Soviet Union, especially of Russia, so that they could simply take over and plunder the world's richest treasure of untapped raw materials and destroy Russian culture once and for all. So Gulen's project, or the CIA's Gulen project, was a vital part of this. And the other part of it was to completely take over the state apparatus of Turkey. And I can, if I may, I would like to read you a quote from my book, The Lost Hegemon, in a speech, a sermon that he gave secretly to his followers before he was forced into exile, because the sermon was recorded by the secret police in Turkey. He said to his followers, "You must move in the arteries of the system without anyone noticing your existence until you reach all the power centers. You must wait for the time when you are complete and conditions are ripe." This sounds like Lenin, huh? "Until we can shoulder the entire world and carry it. You must wait until such time as you have gotten all the state power in Turkey. Until that time, any step taken would be too early, like breaking an egg without waiting the full 40 days for it to hatch." And yeah, that I think gives you a rather good idea of what the project was. Now, the confusing thing for many people, first of all, I think Recep Erdogan, the president of Turkey today, who was the target of the CIA Gulen coup attempt, failed coup, back on the 15th of July, Erdogan himself is rather confused as to who he is and where he must go and so forth. So he looks to make deals with everybody and their grandmother if he thinks at that moment it's going to benefit him. So he's not exactly the deepest, most clear thinking of leaders that Turkey could possibly have, but he's what they've got right now, and he's fighting for his personal life as well as his political life, and that leads him to take certain moves that are very, very unhappy for Washington. Now, you asked what the reason is for this CIA Gulen coup attempt against Erdogan. And it's very clear if you look carefully at what has happened since May of this year. Before May of this year, Erdogan's son was documented to be profiteering off of the illegal stolen oil from Syrian oil wells as well as from Iraqi oil wells, and was selling them on the black market to Asian companies who didn't care where the oil came from as long as the price was nice. And that was the son of Erdogan. The son-in-law at the time was appointed energy minister of Turkey, so it was all a nice little closed family thing. But Erdogan also made deals with the arch enemy Iran. Erdogan, the Muslim Brotherhood close associate and so forth, made deals with the archenemy Iran for selling Iranian oil back when the sanctions were on 2-3 years ago. And the same Erdogan was secretly financing and training in secret bases inside Turkey across the border from Syria, training jihadists recruited from all over the world, from China, from Central Asia, from Russia, from Chechnya, the Islamic part of Russia that has had so much CIA-fostered jihad violence in the last 20 years, and sending them into Syria to topple Bashar al-Assad because he was convinced by perhaps his prime minister at that time, Davutoğlu, who since has been fired by Erdogan, he was convinced that to topple Assad was the way that Turkey can become the energy hub of the entire Middle East vis-a-vis Europe. So being a man of great fantasies, that appealed to Erdogan's grandeur. And he went with that until at some point he became convinced, and no one knows quite what that point was, but he did become convinced to fire his prime minister, Davutoğlu. The Germans were very upset. The Americans were very upset. And he appointed essentially a crony who was going to do everything Erdogan wanted and not make secret intrigues in collusion with NATO behind Erdogan's back. So at that point, the Turkish foreign policy of Erdogan began a 180-degree shift. First of all, and ironically, this was encouraged by John Kerry in the U.S. State Department, Erdogan began to negotiate a rapprochement with Israel, with which he had been on bitter terms for about 4 or 5 years after this Palestinian rescue ship was invaded by Mossad agents a few years ago, and also the Davos attacks on Erdogan from Israel. And the same day that Erdogan announced a meeting with Netanyahu and a framework for rapprochement with Israel, Erdogan apologized, of all things, to Vladimir Putin and the Russian people for the shooting down by a Turkish jet of a Russian jet flying over Syrian airspace, not over Turkish airspace, as Erdogan originally claimed, but he had to deny it because it wasn't true. And he began laying the basis for rapprochement of all unexpected things with Russia. And shortly after that, the new prime minister announced that Turkey would be open to dialogue with Satan himself, Bashar al-Assad, on some kind of a peace negotiation over Syria. The main backer, together with Saudi Arabia, in terms of money, in terms of training, with the U.S. always in the background, Recep Erdogan was suddenly talking peace with Bashar al-Assad. And that has very much to do with the terms that Russia was proposing to Erdogan for a genuine reconciliation. The South Stream gas pipeline would come back to Turkey, into Greece, and potentially on into the European Union. And as well, Israeli gas from the Leviathan field would be participated in by Gazprom and brought partially through pipeline into Turkey, so that Turkey would become, in reality, a real energy hub of the region, but not at the expense of Syria. So a brilliant series of diplomatic moves, primarily on the part of Russia, not on the part of Erdogan, created something that Erdogan couldn't refuse, as Don Corleone would say, an offer he couldn't refuse. So he accepted it. And days after that was made public, this coup attempt took place. Of course, Obama is going to vehemently deny it, but the more vehemently someone denies something, the more smell there is that it's true. And the more vehemently, you can go on the blog page of Graham E. Fuller, just Google the name, Graham E. Fuller, the former project handler of the Gulen project, back when he was very senior member of the CIA. And Graham E. Fuller writes in his blog post, vehemently denying that he had anything to do, or that the CIA had anything to do with the coup d'etat against Erdogan in Turkey. So, you know, were Graham Fuller innocent, he certainly wouldn't open his mouth as a trained senior CIA person. He simply would let it die on the vine.
Okay, William, let me interject, because there's a lot of information you've just shared. Let me try to put this in perspective. On the one hand, prior to this coup, the United States, with a full knowledge of what was going on, knew that not just Saudi Arabia and Qatar and the United Arab Emirates were supplying funds or arms two terrorist groups, but that the two largest funders of terrorists, including ISIS and ISIL and al-Nusra, all of the different ones, was Saudi Arabia and Turkey. Hence, yes. Turkey and Saudi Arabia were allies in that, ideological allies. But also, the oil that was funding, the dollars from the oil being stolen out of Syria and Iraq by over 13,000 tankers for more than 14 months straight, not one of those was blown up. And yet the United States, on the one hand, we were seeing what was happening with terrorists and their capital, the caliphate's capital. And we were saying, gee whiz, isn't that terrible? We should do more. And some were advocating boots on the ground and more airstrikes. And there were some airstrikes, but not one where it could have crippled the oil going from Iraq and from Syria being stolen by Turkey. And the man behind that was the president we're talking about. And his son was then negotiating black market prices to give big deals to Israel and other countries that wanted to buy it for less than half price what the world market would have been. Turkey doesn't make the best, Syria doesn't have the best oil. It's not the sweet crude. It's a coarser crude, so it's not as profitable for them. However, even the president's daughter ran a hospital in Turkey that ISIS and terrorists who were injured would go to with safe transportation. Also, not once did the United States, France, Great Britain, or NATO bomb or in any way stop this open road going from Turkey into Syria. We were just flooding terrorists from all over the world through Turkey. So on the one hand, this is a person who sponsors terrorism, could easily be called a genocidalist, who would easily be found guilty of crimes against humanity because of his support for all this terrorism, what the terrorists did. Yes. So the United States is playing both sides. And now
isn't
we find
familiar?
And now the United States has been caught. So then something changes, and now the president of Turkey wants to have more open relationship with Russia and is even considering talking, having reestablishing diplomatic relations with Syria and Assad. So that goes against every one of the hegemonic programs of power and control and regime change and exploiting gas route, transporting it through Turkey. All this gets thrown in upheaval. So then they say coup now. From what I've understood from all the sources that are at least credible sources, it went something like this. When Erdogan went to reestablish relations with Russia, that we're trying to paint as this evil empire with NATO, and it's Turkey's a member of NATO, but it's not a member of the European Union, and suddenly we're surrounding the borders of Russia with NATO bases in those countries and making it look like they're a threat to the world, and they're a threat to nobody. And they're not out invading countries. They're not going to nuke anyone. They're too successful, and they're kleptocrats. They're utterly corrupt, the Putin's group, but they're corrupt in a way that does not destroy their own country.
They're nationalist corrupt.
Yeah, they're nationalist corrupt. So on the one hand,
George Soros is internationalist corrupt.
Yes. So now they say, let's get him out of office. So they planned a coup with these thousands of individuals, top peoples in their military, the police, and media, so they could get him out, make it look like it was necessary because he was eroding constitutional rights and arresting journalists and his own citizens. They were going to do to him what they did to Gaddafi and what they did to Saddam Hussein. They're going to do the same playbook. It worked with those other two in the media and the American public, clueless as always. Decided, let's go along with this. So I guess as long as you're bringing freedom and a democracy to Turkey, good. We won't ask any questions. In the process, his chief of intelligence got wind of it. And then he began to look and see that there were buildup that shouldn't have happened, that he was not aware of, that none of his military commanders were aware of troops at a rarely used military installation. That then caused an investigation very quick, within hours. And then they found that, okay, it looks like this might be a rogue group of individuals going to create a military coup, which Turkey's had several. So then he immediately tries to get a hold of the president of Turkey and his family and his entourage and get them out, because otherwise they intended to be assassinated. And then they got him out. And then this threw the timeline for the full coup out of sync. So now they didn't have everything working. It's like someone suddenly runs into your room and says, there's a fire, you got to get out, and you're in the middle of the sleep, and you don't have time to take anything, and you get, you know, one boot on and one your underwear on, you go running out the door. So the coup was implemented with the full knowledge and instigation of the CIA, the National Security Agency, and President Obama and Hillary Clinton, all aware of it, but they weren't prepared. So they screwed up, and they cut all the media so that he wouldn't have a form, but he had one form over the internet and a CNN outlet. And he told his more religious, more theocratic, more conservative Islamic believers and citizens of Turkey, go to the streets. They're trying to take over our country. They'll ruin our lives. And so hundreds of thousands of people in Turkey went to the streets, and that stopped it. And then he immediately regrouped, and his intelligence sources and the ones he trusted in the military went about stopping the coup and then arresting everyone, including a lot of people who were probably completely innocent, and settling old debts about anyone he didn't like or anything he didn't like. He's just sweeping them all up like the Crusades. Kill them all and let God sort it out. But in the process, we have – that's what I've heard. How accurate is that?
What I think is missing, and this I'm convinced of, is – it wasn't so much Hakan Fidan, the head of MIT Turkish intelligence, who picked up advance notice of this coup. In fact, he was asleep on the job, according to Turkish accounts that I've been told of by informed people in Turkey in the last days. The key was that Russian intelligence across the border at their base in Syria, because of the shootdown of that Russian jet late last year over Syrian airspace, they developed very sophisticated electronic intercept capability to try to get advance notice of anything planned toward them from Incirlik, the NATO airbase of Turkey near the Syrian border, where the U.S. has predominant presence, has, I think, 19 nuclear warheads. And its major base next to Ramstein in Germany for the Middle East. And they picked up the fact that a coup was being planned and that a capture of Erdogan was part of that. And that was conveyed immediately, of course, to the Russian president, who picked up, they apparently have some kind of hotline between Erdogan personally and Putin, and got on the phone with Erdogan and said, they're coming to get you. They're coming to kill you. And Erdogan, being a survivor animal, began to check that. And he even said this on CNN Turk, that he had indications, he didn't say who, indications that something was afoot. And he immediately, abruptly moved his family to another place. So when the helicopters landed at the hotel where Erdogan reportedly was staying, they found an empty room. And that allowed Erdogan time. And people, Turkish people who watched his face in the first Twitter's videos and social media and interviews that Erdogan gave, they said you could see the fear in his eyes, you know, as the events were not yet clear. And so this was really no joke. This was no false flag nonsense. This was the real deal. And had they captured Erdogan and killed him, that was the plan, then it would be over. There would be a coup. There would be another government in, and we would have Syria Mach 2 in Turkey. Civil war, a complete destruction of that entire country. The world doesn't need another Syria, God forbid. But in any case, that was stopped. And the interesting point is that the Turkish foreign minister made a comment of extraordinary gratitude for Russia's remarkable support during the entire coup process. But he didn't say quite what. So I think that's a more accurate picture. And if anything, I think Hakan Fidan is very close to being fired by Erdogan for the incompetence
okay.
that he did this up earlier.
Now,
so
there's
much disinformation, very much disinformation.
Okay, but this also, now let's take short answers to this. From my perspective, this means that there's not going to be the terrorist automatically going into with carte blanche funding, weapons, oil being stolen, as was the past in Turkey. Turkey will now reenter with Russia being the intermediates to reestablish some diplomatic and possible trade relationships with Syria, which means that all those other terrorists who are in there, including the U.S. and CIA-backed terrorists and the British-backed terrorists and the French-backed terrorists, those
yes.
people are now likely to be identified and targeted and destroyed. So all that we would have expected, the end of Syria, as we saw the end of Iraq and the end of Libya, we're not going to see that same scenario play out in Syria. Your thoughts?
I agree. I agree that for the first time in 5 years, it's a very real possibility. And the key to it is neutralizing the Turkish support for the terrorists against Assad. And if that materializes in the next weeks, the Syrian National Army of Assad and the patriotic militias that have been armed by Assad. Now, that shows that a president has some kind of confidence in his people, that he agrees to arm ordinary citizens to be self-defense militias in their villages against ISIS and al-Nusra terrorists.
Now, is there any possibility that this could blow back on Hillary Clinton in the middle of her presidential campaign if it's shown that she, maybe through WikiLeaks or some other sources, that she knew about all this and was supporting it, much like she did Libya?
Of course it could. There are so many things that should blow back on Hillary Clinton. She should be sitting in front of a jury being tried for crimes against the nation for her email use of without protected servers of highly classified information. The head of the FBI, Comey, in his press conference, indicted her, but then said there's not enough evidence at a court. What kind of nonsense? The FBI isn't a judge. They only present evidence that would have gotten any normal David Petraeus, General Petraeus, the former head of the CIA, was gone because of such leaks to his lover. So, what Hillary did was far, far more criminal. But
what else do you know about Bill and Hillary Clinton that the public is not aware of that would make them more concerned than what they've been?
Well, I think if people look into the records of the Clinton Foundation and the role of Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State in favoring relations with certain wealthy oil-producing countries like Saudi Arabia and other countries, including at times Russia, and how the Clinton Foundation approached Bill Clinton, in personal, approached those same governments and said, gee, we have a little charitable foundation here doing good works all over the world. Maybe you'd like to consider giving a few tens of millions of dollars to our foundation. So here's Hillary Clinton, the U.S. Secretary of State, in dealings officially on behalf of the U.S. government with those same nations, while Bill Clinton, the private citizen, is hustling millions from those same governments in return for favors. Well, that's a pretty interesting trail of investigation. There's another trail that most people have forgotten, and that goes back to when Bill Clinton, in the 1980s, was governor of Arkansas, and before that he was attorney general. And this has been extensively documented by an award-winning British journalist named Ambrose Evans-Pritchard in a book at that time. I have it in my library. I don't know if it's still available even. The Clintons were up to their eyeballs in collusion with CIA illegal narcotics trafficking through a MENA, Arkansas protected airfield. And there were interviews that Ambrose Evans-Pritchard made at the time when Clinton was under the Monica Lewinsky scandal. There were certain Republicans that, of course, would do anything to impeach Bill Clinton and so forth. But there was an investigation of a lot of things Clinton, and they uncovered such filth connected with both Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton in the cover-up of this MENA, Arkansas, CIA cocaine trafficking from South America. Barry Seal was the pilot. He ended up mysteriously dead at a certain point. There are other people who ended up mysteriously dead who knew inside information about all this. So that's something that serious investigation ought to reopen if somebody is a candidate to become president of the United States and the most important political officer in the world, potentially. There are so many areas. Any one of them would have toppled an ordinary person. But the fact is there are very powerful interest groups such as Wall Street, Goldman Sachs, and so forth, such as George Soros, such as Google, the head of Google, who have everything to gain by having Hillary as their marionette in Washington to make wars where they want to make wars, to get rid of opposition in countries where they want to open certain channels. And Hillary is unprincipled enough to do any and all for a price. That seems
I consider her the most dangerous presidential candidate that I know of in American history, because what she's capable of doing, based upon the fact that she is a hyper hawk, and would have no compunction about doing anything that serves someone.
She's a cold-blooded killer. Not even a hyper-hawk. She's a cold-blooded killer.
And yet, look at the clueless liberal and democratic community in the United States supporting her at this convention. It's just embarrassing. Now, tell us about the CIA supporting other terrorists. Tell us about the CIA supporting going back. After all, they funded, and back in the 1980s, they funded terrorist organizations and brought them in from several countries, Bosnia and certainly in Afghanistan, to create the Mujahideen.
Yeah,
tell us about
this,
please.
This is really the fascinating saga is too mild a word for it, but mystery that I unraveled in the researching for The Lost Hegemon. And as I did, the plot got deeper and deeper, and the pieces of the puzzle began to fit together. I just had to sit back from my computer and say, oh my Lord, what have you uncovered here? And let's go back in history. The Muslim Brotherhood, I mentioned this briefly in our last talk, the Muslim Brotherhood was created by an Egyptian school teacher, small town guy named Hassan al-Banna, in 1928. At that time, Egypt was a British protectorate or British colony. And the Brotherhood was a secret society. It had a public part, charitable works, and blah, blah, blah. And it had a private part called the Secret Terror Army, doing wet works, you know, everything the CIA does, or any Mossad or any intelligence agency. And during World War II, they turned against the British in Egypt and were persona non grata. So the leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood fled Egypt and ended up in, of all places, Berlin. Now, at that time, if you recall, during the 1940s, Berlin was under the rule of a man named Adolf Hitler in the Third Reich. Well, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, who was a leading Muslim brother, became intimate friends, and this is not an exaggeration, with Heinrich Himmler, the head of the feared SS, the one who was responsible for the Holocaust, for the genocide against the Jews and Gypsies and others. And he was given control of one of the most powerful radio senders in all of Europe, out of Berlin, to broadcast in Arabic language into the Arab-speaking world daily broadcasts against the Jews in Palestine and so forth, and in support of Germany into the Arab world. After the war, you had an entire network of these Islamists that had been trained by the Muslim Brotherhood in Berlin. They had been in active duty against Tito in Yugoslavia, working with the Bosnian Muslims, and they had been active in the Muslim parts of the Soviet Union underground. And after the war, after Germany lost the war, many of these had come back from Eastern Europe and tried to vanish into the woodwork in Munich, of all places, where their command headquarters were at the time. Well, in the 50s, the CIA station chief in Munich stumbled on this old Nazi network and the leaders of that old Nazi network and began to realize this was a gold mine to make dirty tricks against the Soviet Union during the Cold War. So they began working with these Muslim brothers in Munich. And then they said, well, okay, let's go to the source. Let's go to Egypt. So Miles Copeland was the station chief of the CIA years ago as a journalist, investigative journalist. I interviewed him when he was retired and kind of living in his glory. And he used to brag about some of these things. He was a little bit loose in the mouth for an ex-CIA, but you know, he wanted some recognition, like many people. In any case, Miles Copeland, a CIA station chief, arranged the Underground Railroad smuggling of the leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood out of Egypt in the 50s, after they had been charged with an assassination attempt during a speech of Gamal Abdel Nasser, who at that point had been isolated from credit for the construction of the dam in Egypt and turned to the Soviet Union, not because he was a Soviet agent, but because he had leverage against the West through that. And so the Muslim Brotherhood had to get out, and the CIA knew the network, and they said, we can use them. Let's bring them to Saudi Arabia. Wow, what a stroke of genius. So the CIA convinced the royal family, the Sauds, that they should accept these highly educated Muslim brothers in Saudi Arabia as teachers, as imams, as professors in their universities, because they had a manpower problem. There are very few Saudis. You know, these are desert roaming, camel riding Bedouins for the most part in the royal family. So the marriage ensued. I call it an obscene marriage between the Muslim Brotherhood, this secret society, much like a Freemason secret society or any other number of the Jesuit orders, another model, and the Wahhabite, hyper-conservative, pre-Middle Age strain of Sunni Islam that the Saudi royal family protects since the 1700s. The ones who want to break all the statues and you know, rob the grave of the Prophet Muhammad because that's a desecration. Crazy people. In any case, the marriage of those two gave the Muslim Brotherhood Saudi oil millions for the first time. So they began setting up, and the deal was, the deal with the Saudi royals, now evidence is the Saudi royal family are not the most devout and true practitioners of Islam. In fact, they whore around, they drink around, they beat their women, they have ultimate violations in the United States and so forth that are covered up because they're Saudi royals. But they are the protectors of Mecca and Medina, the two holiest sites in Islam. So that gives them a lot of power over the Sunni world. And they said, okay, Muslim brothers, you go outside Saudi Arabia and we will give you the money. Leave us alone. Don't mess with us. And that worked for decades. And that was, here's the interesting part. In 1979, Zbigniew Brzezinski suggested in a memo to President Carter, he was security advisor, that it would be possible to provoke a Soviet invasion of Afghanistan that would give the U.S. an excuse to give Russia or the Soviet Union its own Vietnam, which is what happened in the 1980s in Afghanistan. And lo and behold, that unfolded because the CIA had been working with certain jihadist fanatical networks, Hekmatyar and others, in Afghanistan that were being trained by the Pakistani ISI intelligence, the counterpart of the CIA. And if you know anything about who was running Pakistan back then, it was Zia-ul-Haq, one of the most bloodthirsty, cutthroat jihadists in the history of Islam. The man had blood in his eyes when he looked at you. And he introduced such a radical reactionary Sharia law into Pakistan. And he was 100% backer of NATO and the CIA in training these Afghanis inside Pakistan. So that became what was called the Mujahideen, the freedom fighters, the biggest CIA project up until that point in post-war history. It lasted almost 10 years until the Soviet Red Army threw up the white flag of surrender and got out of Afghanistan. And the man who was brought in with the agreement of U.S. intelligence, the Central Intelligence Agency of the United States of America, at the suggestion of the head of Saudi intelligence, who was head of Saudi intelligence until very, very recently, by the way, was named Osama bin Laden. And he was the son of one of the wealthiest families in Saudi Arabia, whose family had a bin Laden construction company that made all the royal palaces. And there are a lot of royals and a lot of palaces, so they made a pretty good fortune, the bin Laden family in Saudi Arabia. So Osama bin Laden was chosen to be the point man in Pakistan to recruit Saudi jihadists, to recruit Syrian jihadists, to recruit Pakistani jihadists, any place in the Muslim world where the Muslim Brotherhood had a recruiting possibility. And that was what became the Mujahideen. Well, they didn't disappear. There's a myth that the CIA projected that, oh, this guy bin Laden came back to bite us because we simply forgot about the Mujahideen and Osama bin Laden after the Russians left Afghanistan. And then we didn't pay so much attention. That's a lie. They airlifted the leading figures of the Mujahideen, including Osama bin Laden, by eyewitness accounts in Bosnia and elsewhere, into Azerbaijan with the collapse of the Soviet Union, when Azerbaijan, with its Baku oil riches, declared a republic free from the Soviet Union. And at that point, the Russian Federation was in no shape to protest anything. They were a complete chaos and shambles under Yeltsin. So the CIA brought in these Mujahideen first to Azerbaijan to create a coup d'etat there and install the Aliyev family as president to give the oil rights to the oil riches of Baku, used to be Soviet Union oil, offshore Baku in the Caspian Sea, to British Petroleum and the American Atlantic Richfield, which later merged with BP, so it's now BP. The Anglo-American oil companies got the rights to Azeri oil after the Mujahideen coup d'etat. Then they brought the Mujahideen through CIA airlines. By the way, some of the CIA figures, General Secord and others, were instrumental in this whole operation that were involved in Iran-Contra under the Bush Senior administration. They brought them into Russia, into Chechnya. Now, if you look at a map and look at an oil
we only have 1 minute to go, so you, please wrap it up. Make your final points, please.
Okay. So the point is, this network has been cultivated by the CIA for decades. They instrumentalize so-called religion. It has nothing to do with religion. It has to do with military control of the oil resources of the Middle East and the world.
So simply said, many of the coups, many of the regime changes in the old Soviet republic, many of the changes around the world have nothing to do with anything except the CIA working on behest of special groups and funding and training terrorist groups. So if we really wanted to get rid of terrorism, we'd have to get rid of the CIA and all the other people
that
support.
Might not be a bad idea. John Kennedy was about to do that.
Should have done it. Should have gotten rid of all these security agencies. Yeah, and that's how it works. Well, thank you very much for sharing these wonderful insights because we did not know all this, and now we do. And now we have a better perspective. And could you imagine now, as people go forward watching this very strange dance and ritual of supposedly selecting the best person to be president, and the world knows none of the truth of any of this, nor will it from the media. But they can if they read The Lost Hegemon, Whom the Gods Would Destroy, by my guest, F. William Engdahl. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Gary.
I'm Gary Noll, and I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day, everyone.